In 882, Rurik's successor, Prince Oleg.
Hello and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast, the only podcast that has the freedom to be honest. I am joined, as always, by the wonderful Robert Morris. How have you been now you're back from your skiing?
I'm all right. I had a lovely time skiing. It was great. And was congratulating myself on managing to complete it without injury. And then I was doing a little bit of calisthenics yesterday morning, and my back blew out.
Sounds bad.
It's, you know, I think it's better than it has been in some of my past experience. But it is just another reminder that I am in my 40s and stumbling around. How are you doing, Rory?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Haven't been up too much, thankfully, except I've been obsessed with a game called Two Point Hospital.
Two Point Hospital? What's that about?
You run a hospital. It's a spiritual successor to Theme Park Theme Hospital, and I just am obsessed with it. Any moment I have, I'll be playing that, trying to run a hospital, get it to 3 stars, move on to the next. So that's what I've been mostly doing.
We do complain about U.S. healthcare a lot on this channel, so hopefully that'll spread, and maybe one day the United States will figure out how to run a healthcare system.
Okay. Sadly, I think it knows how to, but also knows how to make a very profitable one instead.
Oh God, is that the goal of the game?
Yes, you have to make them healthy, and you have to have the profitable hospital to make more things. It's funny, I think it's originally a British developer, so there's like a weird novelty to a hospital where you make money instead of just turn up and get treated.
Speaking from the US context, it's not a novelty you need.
No. Speaking of being radicalized by things abroad, have you been radicalized by shopping trolleys?
Shopping trolleys, yes. They're terrifying, and especially the coin operated variety.
Do you get them in America?
My politics on a daily. I think I've seen them before.
Oh, okay, because it's one thing with when you see American shows, you're always like, they just throw their shopping trolleys everywhere. Do they not want their money back? But yeah, there is no money involved. But yes, that is not a Russian thing. It seems to be quite common throughout Europe, and I assume throughout.
Yeah, well, what is for certain is that Tucker Carlson hasn't seen it much before.
Yes, a multi-millionaire of that caliber, I don't think really does his own shopping.
I don't know that he's ever... I don't know when the last time he's seen the inside of a supermarket is.
But Tucker Carlson met one of the few people on Earth that is more detached from reality than himself, and that would be one Vladimir Putin.
Indeed. It's interesting. By the time this airs, I suppose this might be 2 week old news, but I did think it was interesting enough to go through in detail this interview that Tucker Carlson conducted with Vladimir Putin in Russia on February 6th, 2024. I think it says a fair amount about Russia, about Putin, about the current conflict, and also about the particular delusions that motivate Tucker Carlson, formerly one of the most influential media figures in the United States. How influential is he now? Well, nobody knows.
I think still very influential. And I was, for research for this, I listened to a podcast called Ukraine Without the Hype. And they were pointing out that he's both quite popular in Russia and previously in Ukraine, but you can understand why that's not so popular. Quite often when one of his shows would be up, a lot of people would quickly translate it and then publish it around the world. So no, he's definitely a man with a lot of heft, and still I think he's earning quite a few bucks on the internet, although he's not on the television as much anymore.
Well, it's a very interesting question. What happens to these figures when they go out on their own? We're certainly used to Fox News having a certain footprint. And it's a question. I've seen the conversation go in a number of directions in the, has it been a year or 6 months or so since Tucker Carlson lost his seat at Fox News? How damaging is this for Fox News? How much of an individual platform is Tucker Carlson going to have? And I think the jury is still out. I think we discussed in the last podcast briefly, where we talked about the careers of Tucker Carlson and Jon Stewart, that there was right-wing political figure who was a very big deal 10, 15 years ago named Glenn Beck, who became famous through Fox News, got too nutty for Fox News and was fired. But apparently he's still got a whole media empire out there with podcasts and this, that, and the other thing. And it's not clear that he's reaching fewer people than he was reaching when he was at Fox News. It's just that we're all less aware of it. Jon Stewart is less likely to spend a whole bunch of time talking about you if you're running some podcast than if the main primetime spot on Fox News.
Well, there are just some mediums that are a bit more, you know, they get themselves out in the wild. There was a podcast I used to listen to, the Blind Boy podcast, and he was giving off that he did a radio interview that he didn't really pay much attention for, and he's like, my podcast has so many more listeners, and yet I hear nothing about me in the media, but yet I do one little tiny radio interview, and it's all over the news, and my mum and all her friends are complaining about it. So there's just some mediums that get around significantly better than, yeah, quite often I think it's like you'll hear about some televangelist preacher in America that's like worth nearly $1 billion. You're like, I've never heard of him. Some people can just stay in their little aisles and nobody seems to know them outside of anywhere.
But they do influence voters, and Beck and a bunch of little islands like that are probably drive a lot more partisan craziness than we're aware of. And so it's an open question. Tucker Carlson, I think for the past couple months, 3 months, I'm not sure how much, has been putting out a talk show on Twitter or X, as it is now known. Yes. On Elon Musk's...
Although they still keep Twitter.com. Like, no one else can buy that when you think if it isn't called Twitter anymore, you would be able to.
Well, yeah. I think they know that probably wouldn't go very well
yes.
if they did that. And I think they still own the Twitter name. They want to retain the ability to either use it or sell it or
switch back
or
when Elon is distracted with something else.
Anything's possible, Rory. Anything's possible. The question of how successful Tucker Carlson's new media ventures are sort of in the black hole of how successful is anything on Twitter. He's apparently being well paid by Elon Musk to some degree, but is that related to metrics? Is, you know, there's certainly views that are shown for these videos. How accurate are they? Who knows? As with any media empire, they decided to pull a stunt. And the stunt that they decided to pull was to send Tucker Carlson to the Kremlin to interview Vladimir Putin.
So is this backed by X in any way? Or because I heard him saying, oh, my show was on X, but I thought that was just like it's on a load of platforms and X is one of them.
No. It is on X. I don't know that anybody knows the intricacies of the contractual relationship between Tucker Carlson's show and X, the platform, but that is the main delivery system. I watched this whole interview on X.
Wow. I just went to YouTube.
The whole thing's available there?
Oh, yeah. 18 million views.
18 million views on YouTube. Oh, interesting. And I suppose to what extent we can trust it, but on X, it has... On X, they claim it has 206.9 million views.
Okay.
Which, frankly, strikes me as impossible. What that would mean to me is those look to me like Facebook metrics, which are famously used in the context of people claiming that a billion people saw Russian ads related to the 2016 election. It's Facebook metrics, which basically if somebody scrolls by it, that's a view.
It just happens to be on the screen. I think, yeah, the videos they were counting, I know Facebook where it was like, if it played for 3 seconds, that counted as a view as if you watched it for an hour. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas YouTube views are a little, I think you need to watch 30 seconds before a view is, or at least classically, you needed to watch 30 seconds before a view was marked on YouTube, which is a lot more honest. I would be absolutely shocked if, and also Twitter has famously recently implemented, if you scroll by it, the video starts blaring at you.
Short form content? Oh yeah, autoplay.
Autoplay, yeah, it's irritating. I can't surf Twitter. I can't listen to music and surf Twitter on my phone anymore because every time I scroll by a video, it starts autoplaying and turns off my music.
I wonder the opinion if you were to give Elon some money? Maybe is that a feature that...
A feature I could disable?
We talked about before, they make the app slowly worse until you pay.
Well, regardless, I would be absolutely shocked if 200 million people watched more than 15 seconds of this thing, because it is incredibly boring.
But also considering, I think only about a quarter of it is a history lesson.
In 882, Rurik's successor, Prince Oleg...
An alternative history lesson, but all anyone talks about is that, so I think most people don't get past that, and I can totally understand why.
That is a really key point. My greatest quibble here is, as you well know, and as I think most viewers well know, I am a firm adherent of the NATO expansion created the Ukraine crisis theory. Interview starts off with Tucker Carlson giving Vladimir Putin the opportunity to confirm that, saying, you know, was this related to NATO? Vladimir Putin launches into the aforementioned history lesson. And what really confirms that most commentators and sadly, some journalistic institutions, including the Washington Post, never watched more than the first 20 minutes of this thing is that, yes, he did not take that first opportunity to blame NATO because he wanted to deliver his history lesson, but repeatedly over and over through this two-hour conversation, he makes very, very clear that the reason the war has occurred is because of Western betrayal, because of NATO expansion, because of. And I'm not saying that we should take Vladimir Putin at his word. We should, you know, take Henry Kissinger or George Kennan or the dozens of serious analysts of this conflict or the dozens of serious political figures who predicted exactly this result when NATO started to expand in the 1990s. We should never take Vladimir Putin at his word, but I do think it's outrageous that the main takeaway from this interview seems to have been that, oh, Vladimir Putin said it wasn't NATO, which is the exact opposite of what he says repeatedly, but you got to make it to the you know, the 30-minute mark before he starts talking about that. And as you pointed out, I don't think many people other than us did, Rory.
Well, we were promised no NATO to the east, not an inch to the east, as we were told. And then what? They said, well, it's not enshrined on paper, so we'll expand.
Yes, I'd be curious to see how many people get past the two-hour mark in this interview.
Oh, yes, it is not. It's irritating. But we did it. We did it, or at least, did you watch, did you listen to the whole two-hour thing?
I did, yes.
My God.
Yeah. So, one strange thing is I kind of find myself sort of nodding along, because it's not, you know, you're not hearing Vladimir Putin, you're hearing the interpreter. So you sort of hate, because you're not used to his voice, and you sort of think, oh, that's nice, and you sort of nod along, and then you hold on a minute and you go, has he just compared himself to Hitler? You just find yourself going, wait a minute, because you're trying to, it's almost like, you know, if you're in a conversation with someone, you're trying to be polite. And then at a certain point, you just catch yourself going, what did he just say? And then there's the horrible thing where, have you ever seen or played a historical game where you're slowly essentially changing the course of history and you're a bit like, no, this isn't real. I shouldn't believe this. I find myself trying to like, oh, this is all kind of a bit nonsense. Don't believe it too much, because it's just a strange way of basically blaming everything on something that happened in 1862.
Yeah, it's a warped, very strange worldview. I am excessively American in my view of things, that I just don't really believe that anything that happened before the Industrial Revolution matters much. The selective history that Putin describes of the run-up of why Ukraine belongs to Russia, despite my lack of belief that it matters, I have studied, you know, these eras and these things to some extent, and I didn't really see any glaring errors before the 20th century. Did you pick up on anything? I think what it was is just incredibly selective. It's just sort of like, well, we're just going to take this data point from 800, and then we're going to take this data point from 918, and then we're going to take this point. And it was sort of like a masterclass in the ridiculousness of most national self-conceptions.
Well, in that there, Ukraine without the hype, they were pointing out that during the Soviet Union, the sort of upper crusty types would go to like ballrooms and dinner parties, And a very popular thing would be to sort of, you know, your politician is doing something and you just have like a completely warped ramble about history. And that was a very sophisticated, normal thing to do. And apparently that's exactly what Vladimir Putin has done here. He just sort of rambled on. Oh, everything's like this because of all these events in history.
It is interesting because it's such a... Tucker Carlson is a terrible interviewer.
His interviewing was a lot, because I'd heard a lot of the hype about this before seeing it. He does ask more questions than I was expecting. He's not as terrible. Mm-hmm. He's not just completely thinking Vladimir Putin's done everything right. He does ask something, but yeah, definitely is lacking. But I think it's also hard to interview Vladimir Putin, I would say.
Of course.
Especially in his isolationist phase, I think this is referred to as.
But the fact that Putin opened with this, just a complete lack of respect for Tucker Carlson, which is, maybe understandable, but it was just...
It's okay if you're Jon Stewart.
it was fascinating. But yeah, it just gets to the myth at the heart of most nationalisms, this idea that the behaviors or the religious choices of royal courts or whether this or that group of tribes or city-states asked the Duke of Muscovy to be their protector or the Polish-Lithuanian guy to be their protector. It's like these are significant facts. They can be underpin, you know, the reasons why these places are parts of places. But the idea that it conveys this sort of soul deep legitimacy is I think quite ridiculous. I think he did point out at one point it was like actually none of this was really ours until Catherine the Great, you know. So sort of in the 1700s, the most of Ukraine was incorporated in the Russian Empire, and then the Soviets lost it in the 1980s, and that's. Those are the facts on the ground. Those are the facts that matter, as far as I'm concerned. And I am...
The facts in living memory?
Well, the facts of what the borders were.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I am 100%... Please don't take this out of context, but I am 100% with Vladimir Putin on the description of U.S. malfeasance here, on the description of NATO expansion being the real problem, but... I stopped that in February of 2022 when he decided to murder a whole bunch of people. You know, he had very, very, very valid critiques and very, very valid grievances that everybody should have taken very seriously. But he's the one who decided to start a major shooting war. And all of these fairy tales real facts. But real facts that don't have the significance that he wants them to have, sort of tailed together.
And was it the president of Mongolia was a bit like, do you remember the Mongolian Empire? Cough, cough. Like, you know, so many countries can claim other countries because of things they own millennia ago, hundreds of years ago. So it's all a bit. But I think his main point is basically Ukraine isn't really a thing.
I wouldn't.
It's really just land that Russians used to own, and it makes sense that they own it again.
I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I think that that's certainly the interpretation that a lot of folks have pointed out. I think this weird historical lecture that he starts with is an attempt to emphasize, I think a failed attempt to emphasize, because again, I think the broader American perspective is, or U.S. perspective is just sort of like who gives a crap what happened in 900 or 1200 or 1400 or what have you. But I think from the Russian context, I think there is a point that he gets later on where it does seem pretty clear that he sees Ukrainian identity as something to be stamped out, as something that I found most troubling that others didn't. But I think that there is some, in this historical, there is scope for independent existence. There is scope for, but I think what he's trying to illustrate is that like this is Russian territory. This is Russian, not necessarily has to be Russia, but this is Russia's sphere of influence. This is, there are all of these connections, and it is kind of crazy that the U.S. came in and decided to break all those. And I substantially agree with that. I do not agree with the idea that gave him the right to smash through international borders and start a war that has killed people. upwards of 100,000 people.
Thing I find interesting, he keeps making it out like, oh, America keeps betraying my trust, but it kind of comes across like, why do you keep trusting America? Like, are you just silly?
I would wholly co-sign and agree with the sentiment that nobody should trust the United States of America, but that does seem a little cynical.
Because he brings it up multiple times, and it's a bit like, well, when are you going to learn? What's the, you know, shame on me once, but shame on you twice sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think his response to that, Rory, would be like, yes, I learned. I decided to launch a major war. I tried for 20 years, and I decided to launch a major war. I think that was obviously the wrong decision. I do have some sympathy with the frustration of Russian policymakers at looking at what the United States has done. What I have no sympathy for is the story that he starts telling about Ukraine and Russia in the 20th century. The thing that kept jumping out at me was he'd talk about, I don't think he quite comes out and says this, but he seems to be asserting that Lenin and Stalin invented Ukraine.
So in this sense, we have every reason to affirm that Ukraine is an artificial state that was shaped at Stalin's will.
Even though I think you could argue Stalin destroyed Ukraine the most than anyone else in history. Is it the green Ukrainians in, you know, off beside China and stuff like that? It is fascinating that he accounts, you know, the man that destroyed Ukraine the most with sort of inventing it.
Well, I don't know how to pronounce this, but it's Holodomor or something, like the sort of Ukrainian, the mass starvation of Ukrainians.
Oh,
that
yes,
Stalin,
yes.
That
as well.
Initiated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question that Stalin was horrific for the Ukrainians. Which you're exactly right, makes it all the more outrageous that, I mean, I see the historical point that he's making, that the Ukrainian SSR...
And he also downplays Stalin as well, which is incredible.
Well, what's interesting is, so there's so much about Putin that is about downplaying the crimes of Stalin and talking, you know, trying to rehabilitate Stalin. Yet it's interesting that in this dynamic, you know, he's not calling out Stalin's mass starvation of the Ukrainians. He's not talking about the mass... ethnic cleansing or sort of population transfers you were talking about. But he is actually kind of saying that the Soviets, Lenin and Stalin, screwed up by inventing Ukraine. So it's interesting because normally he's a big Stalin defender, or at least portrayed as such. But in this context, he's blaming them for putting... And I don't know if this is a artifact of translation or something like that, but he keeps talking about unknown reasons why Lenin and Stalin, you know, did this. And they're not unknown reasons. They're very obvious reasons. It's because the Soviet Union at its outset was incredibly weak, was a revolutionary outfit that considered nationalism a part of, you know, providing a true appreciation for nationalism and the self-determination of peoples to be a key part of what they were doing. And they also desperately needed to provide a better deal to the Ukrainians than the Polish were. So these are not unknown reasons. They are really basic...
Inconvenient reasons is the gist.
Exactly. They are reasons that highlight the fact that after the Tsars, Russia had nowhere near as concrete a connection or control over Ukraine as he would like to portray it. So that's sort of an interesting one of the places where his historical... narrative goes from selective and strange to sort of outright lies. And then he gets to World War II and the one that has been quite rightly been harped on by a lot of people. He appears to blame Poland for starting World War II, which is a really, really novel...
Poland turned out to be uncompromising and Hitler had nothing to do but start implementing his plans with Poland.
It is novel, but it's... He weirdly puts himself in the place of Hitler in that the analogy I always thought, because he's basically saying Poland didn't agree to this, so they forced Hitler to invade them. And Ukraine didn't agree to this, so it forced me to invade them.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's very bad optics.
No, you don't want to put yourself in that position. And I think he was like making a case for Poland working with the Nazis at one point, and then he briefly mentions the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Where the Soviets and the Nazis worked together for a couple of years there, but then he just sort of moves on, and it is just fascinating to blame some of the largest victims of World War II for starting World War II, which I think gets back to...
Well, it's strange that he's trying to claim Ukraine's full of Nazis when he's sort of defending the Nazis to try to blame Poland for everything. It's quite convoluted.
All of these things get very confused. And I think it might actually be rooted in the very serious war between Poland and the Russians that was fought around the same time as the Russian Civil War that led to the establishment of the Soviet Union. But it's just this fascinating, as all of this, his sort of historical lecture is filled with just sort of weird throwbacks. I kind of feel like his obsession with Poland is like a throwback to the 1920s, almost in the spirit of the same Lenin and Stalin he's just pilloried for inventing Ukraine. And it's all very nuts. And it's fascinating just sort of watching Tucker Carlson deal with this, or attempt to deal with this.
Well, at the very start, he genuinely seems scared, because he kind of has a very weird, nervous laugh. Is one of the first things he does in response to Putin.
Are we having a talk show or a serious conversation?
Here's the quote.
And then after that, Putin just sort of answers his own questions.
Yeah, Putin isn't very interested in responding to much of anything that Tucker Carlson wants to say throughout.
So I've heard people saying he gets very offended, because even Tucker with his lowball questions is like, no, I'm just going to answer my own thing. How dare you even question me?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think in the Russian context, Putin, obviously, does seem, I've seen footage of his press conferences, and perhaps it's all staged, like where he actually does deal with some harsher questions, this, that, the other thing. But it's pretty clear that he feels like he's doing Tucker Carlson a huge favor, which he definitely is, sees it as an opportunity to sort of get his word out there. And it's just fascinating watching Tucker, this is sort of early on, just trying to pull his standard shtick, where he's interviewing, some hand-selected dumb leftist or whatever, for 6 minutes, and he's doing his like I don't understand face, and then at one point he even starts like smirking at the camera when Putin says something, and it just comes off as strange and not particularly
but he
useful.
Does have one of the most gormless faces in the internet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess around 21 minutes or so, Putin, finally finishes his lecture about medieval times and modernity in the 20th century.
I also like how he points out that it's boring as well.
Yes, exactly. Putin's like, clearly this is bad television, but I don't care, because you decided to give me 2 hours, and I'm just going to...
And you are in the Kremlin, so you will listen.
Probably the one part of Putin's explanation that I did find kind of poignant and kind of interesting, because it's a question I wonder about sometimes, is, what were the Russians thinking in 1989 and 1990 when they let Ukraine go? I mean, what were they thinking? And I think it was actually worth exerting, and I think maybe I'll put it in a video at some point, because they really did think that, and I think this is something that's left out, is that they just sort of assumed that the affinities between Ukraine and Russia were to the extent that, and I think this is in part the point of his historical lecture. He thought that the affinity, he says, the way they thought, family, economy, faith, they were so interlinked that it didn't really matter that much that Ukraine was an independent country, and it was just like a continuation of the Soviet policy, which is like, sure, okay, you're an independent Ukrainian country, have your own language, whatevs, we're going to work together as closely as we work together, and that's fine. They were going to be independent the way Mexico is independent from the United States. It's like, okay.
Or Canada.
Yeah, exactly. The way, more so, really, than Mexico or Canada is independent from the United States. And I think that they had a real legitimate expectation, specifically that NATO would not expand, that they would be welcomed into the community of nations, that things would be okay. And that is not what the United States delivered.
But do you think a lot of that is down to Vladimir Putin's actions?
No, not really.
Okay. But do you think Russia was more democratic, let's say this is the fifth president of Russia or whatever,
yeah.
do you mm-hmm. think America would still be as hostile regardless of what Russia really did?
I think, could Russia have played it better? Sure. Sure. No question.
Sadly, Ukraine and Russia did get on great. Like, the most amount of tourists going to Russia were from Ukraine. They were two very closely connected countries that could have just got on very well together. While I feel like Putin's overstepped his assumption of that.
Well, but it's important to point out, and I do not want to wholly endorse the story that Putin is telling here. It's definitely one-sided. It's definitely, but like, the United States worked really, really hard to ruin that. I've never really looked into 2004 that closely, but this is one of my biggest critiques of Tucker when we get there. But like, it is the extent to which the United States was constantly working to ruin the relationship between Ukraine and Russia is really underemphasized. We had the Orange Revolution in 2004, the Revolution of Dignity in 2014. All of these things were heavily, heavily supported by the United States. And I do think Putin is being not entirely disingenuous when he points out that he really did try to have a degree of openness with the West. He really wanted, he wanted the money, he wanted Russia to participate.
And he seems to really like George Bush.
Yes, that was kind of fascinating, especially considering that it was George Bush who added chunks of the Soviet Union to NATO, and it was actually under George Bush where Russia took its first military steps against NATO expansion.
I had a very good relationship with, say, Bush. I know that in the United States, he was portrayed as some kind of a country boy who does not understand much. I assure you that this is not the case.
Well, because this was a time when sort of Putin was, better accepted in the West?
He was, for a period in the early 2000s, even with his opposition to the Iraq War, he was kind of lionized in the West. Because we had seen, because Russia under Yeltsin was a disaster. Yeltsin was a heroic figure in the early 1990s who seems to have been utterly incapable of governing the country. The place descended into he descended further into alcoholism over the course of the 1990s.
Also, he does defend him. He sort of says, it's alleged that happened. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, that's a fascinating dynamic about Putin, and a fascinating dynamic about Putin that we don't really focus on too much is that we kind of put him in power.
Well, it's seen that he was sort of handpicked.
Well, he was handpicked by Boris Yeltsin, who is a guy who had manifestly demonstrated his utter incapacity by 1996, was in danger of losing to the Communist Party in an open, free and fair election. So the United States stole that election for Yeltsin. This is fairly well documented. We poured a ton of money. We had election consultants on.
The communists are still the enemy.
Exactly. We had election consultants on the ground making sure, that Yeltsin would win that 1996 election. He won that 1996 election. Disaster ensued. I believe there was there was a debt default, I think, in 97 or 98.
Oh, yeah. There was a recession. I think there was a big collapse.
Yeah, Yeltsin fell further into alcoholism, and he picked this St. Petersburg politico to be his successor, and that was Vladimir Putin. So really, the United States kind of, I did a short a while ago, Russia has never, never had a peaceful transition of power. They had one real election in 1996 that the United States stole for Boris Yeltsin. Then Putin was handpicked, and there's a whole mess of stuff around Chechnya and quite possibly, it could have been Chechen bombs, could have been the Russian security services under Vladimir Putin bombs that basically guaranteed him a victory the first time he saw an election, and every election thereafter, Putin has won. We put Vladimir Putin in power. And for that first decade, he was seen as like a useful strongman, like a good guy, because he had sort of knit Russia back together. And, in 2008, I think it was, or no, it's a different cycle. He tried to step back from power. I mean, of course, there's our guy, Dmitry Medvedev, who we love to make fun of. But he was nominally the guy in charge of Russia for 4 years. Putin tried to step back, tried to do those democratic transitions. And it was just became more and more clear that the United States was not interested in letting that happen. It does take two to tango here. Like, Putin is an unattractive figure. He's become progressively less attractive as he has maintained power. But it's also hard to completely discredit his story of events, which is that one of progressive aggression and encirclement from NATO and the United States, which is, you know, to my mind, and I've looked into this a fair bit, exactly what happened. So I see Putin, nasty as he is, as a product of U.S. foreign policy, not so much an antagonist or something along those lines.
At about 21 minutes, he starts talking about Hungarians and how he thinks they're entertainers until he finds out that's their national dress.
Yes, that was a strange moment there, talking about how Ukraine is. So Tucker actually asks him, are you saying that Hungary should be trying to carve off chunks of Ukraine? And he says, Putin's just like, well, I didn't say that, or whatever. And it is strange. It is profoundly strange. I do want to say, like, you know, I've got it over and over and over here, you know, 26 minutes, 39 minutes, 50 something minutes, over and over and over again, Putin emphasizes that the betrayal, the problem is NATO, over and over and over again. The fact that a military organization, you know, the carving off of Ukraine by both the military organization NATO and the economically centered organization, the EU, are things that, you know, he was prepared to negotiate about, but was not prepared to accept as sort of fait accompli. And, you know, he points back to the 1990s and U.S.'s treatment of Serbia as just sort of the start of this process, points out that this is a claim that he's making. I find it a credible claim, but I don't actually have proof of this, that the United States supported Chechens against the Russian government. There's no question that it was open U.S. policy during the 1970s and 1980s to support Muslim fundamentalists against the Soviet Union within Afghanistan and in Russia. That's open U.S. policy. So maybe all of that funding stopped in 1992, but I kind of doubt it.
But I think it's a perfect thing to throw in because, like, you know, the CIA and all the likes are very secretive. So it's like, oh, well, the fact there's no evidence proves how good they are. Like, it's one of those. It's just perfect sort of fodder for this.
But it's not that there's really no evidence. Like, this is it's open. This was open, more or less openly acknowledged to be the policy of the United States in the 1970s and the 1980s.
Oh, yes, yes.
And did it change in the 1990s? Certainly the Clinton administration claims it did. But, like, I would lean probably a little more to the Russian side on this question, but I can't say anything definitively.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I mean, this points out that, like, at the point when Russia was doing everything it could to, you know, he actually says at some point, Putin actually says at 28 minutes that there were, like, five waves of expansion. And he says, we were saying, please don't. We're as bourgeoisie as you are. You know, like this, you know, just screaming, the Cold War's over. Please stop doing this. And certainly you can tell a story where it was good that the United States would be supporting the Chechens. I think you can tell a story that I would even believe where it was good that the United States was bombing the Serbs in 1995. I don't think it was necessarily, it's not clear to me that it was good that the United States was bombing Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, in 1999. But because of the very deep, longstanding, I mean, this is sort of what World War I is about, the affinity between Serbs and Russians, you know, things were being constantly thrown in Russia's face. And I have some sympathy with that. I think that's true.
But do you think the fact that there was never, like, a proper, you know, written document to say NATO wouldn't expand, it's quite often just referenced to this one conversation that it never was in writing, so it's not like there's a great big treaty that, you know, America has destroyed. It just feels a bit like, well, if you didn't get it in writing, like, tough luck.
Oh, I have no sympathy for that. I think it gets back to my really fundamental, like, the United States is in charge. Like, I don't see Russia as our equal. I see Russia as our, like, as our children, fundamentally. I keep using this. It's a terrible analogy. I should stop doing it. I apologize preemptively. But in my world, the way that I view the world, Rory, is the United States is the adult, and the rest of the countries are the people that we're responsible for. They're our children. You know, we, like that's just, that's not because we're smarter. It's just because we're infinitely more powerful. The relationship between the United States and every other country in the world is the relationship of an adult to a child.
Or they've taken them hostage.
Yes, yes, or something along those lines. We have all the weapons. We have all the power. Perhaps that's a better one. You know, the hostage taker to the hostages. So when I see, as I've seen over and over from Ben Bradley to other people being like, well, you didn't get it in writing, tough luck, suckers. I see that and it's disgusting to me. It's like an adult like smacking a child around and being like, stop hitting yourself, stop hitting yourself. I find that, like, we didn't get it in writing. I'm getting heated. I find that, like, you didn't get it in writing, so we can lie to you, dumbasses. And keep in mind, this is Gorbachev. This is the guy who was, like, actually, like, I know for the past 50 years, like, it's been written, it's been, like, one of the fundamental constants of the world that we're going to kill each other, that mutually assured destruction is going to happen. This is one of the few heroes, and he's loathed by Russians, I know, but Mikhail Gorbachev is one of the few heroes that history has to offer. I don't know if there's this great film made by Werner Herzog. You know Werner Herzog, the famous German director who's like this, like,
yes,
this, mm-hmm, like, this avatar of darkness and cruelty, and you know, the world is a terrible, terrible place. And there's this incredible film he made about Gorbachev just in the past 4 or 5 years where he just, like, he goes and interviews Gorbachev and he's like a little kid because, like, I meet the person who is actually a good person who made the world incredibly better. And it's very strange because you're like, Werner Herzog, like, what's wrong with you, Werner? But like, you know, apparently the two things that Werner Herzog likes in this world are Mikhail Gorbachev and Star Wars. And, like, this heroic figure who was trying and failing to keep his world together. And he said, look, you know what? Like, we're not going to make a big deal about you reunifying Germany, about, like, you know, writing this great historical wrong. If I just get this commitment from these guys I trust, from George W. Bush and James Baker, that NATO's not going to expand one more inch, right? And they're like, yeah. No, you don't need it in writing. It'll be fine. And this idea that it's okay for the U.S. government to be like, ha-ha, fuck you, it is, you didn't get it in writing. It enrages me, frankly. and that is the point. This like, you know, Lockheed Martin wants us to keep expanding NATO. My understanding, that's more or less how it happened. Every U.S. foreign policy grandee from Henry Kissinger to George Kennan, et cetera, was like, please don't do this. But Lockheed Martin wanted it, and they put a bunch of money into it. So NATO expanded, and now they're selling F-35s to everybody. They got exactly what they wanted. It's just incredibly sinister, and it's the reason why we have a war in Ukraine right now. So, perhaps that's a very long way of explaining that. No, I don't think it's a good argument that...
Well, at least you didn't go back to the year 800.
Yes, I didn't go back to the year 800. That's true. I only went back to when I was in high school. But
if you were coaching Vladimir Putin to basically convince Americans to not support the war in Ukraine, what would you tell him?
I don't think there's a way. I don't think there's really
to get
a way
through
to
Putin
do it.
Or to get through to Americans?
Either, really. I really think that the milk has been spilled, the eggshells have been broken, you know, there's no putting this back together.
Well, it's just because there's the big Republican, I know not all Republicans are, but there seems to be a big Republican push to basically not support Ukraine really at all.
I mean, we'll see how that goes. There's always big pushes to not do this, that, and the other thing. I think fundamentally what's going to end up happening is that's going to force what we wanted anyway, which is not what we wanted anyway, but certainly what Lockheed Martin wanted anyway, which is just a new South Korea in the middle of the old Soviet Union, which is, some kind of demilitarized zone. And fundamentally, I think this is a really important takeaway from this interview that does not come across in much of the analysis, is just how desperately weak Vladimir Putin looks here. Vladimir Putin is being standoffish, is treating Tucker Carlson with a complete lack of respect. But he is like the nominal leader of a country with the pretensions to being a superpower.
And I think theoretically he's the richest man on earth, in the sense that there's nothing really Vladimir Putin can't get sort of beyond laws. Like Jeff Bezos still has to obey some laws, while Vladimir Putin, you know, he's a law unto himself.
Could Vladimir Putin get an interview with Christiane Amanpour on CNN? Could he? I mean, that's an open question.
I think they would be up for it, definitely.
I mean, would they? Because Tucker Carlson clearly submitted to all kinds of conditions that no more serious journalist would submit to. You know, if Christiane Amanpour, I don't know, it's a name that sticks in my head. She's still working for CNN, but I think she's sort of like the go-to woman that has done the big interviews for CNN for years. But I think if she were to do it, she would have talked about Navalny. She would have talked.
Well, he hadn't died at this point, but he was definitely in jail.
She would have talked about Navalny. She would have talked about all the other people who've been poisoned. She would have had real follow-ups. She would not have allowed Vladimir Putin, head of state or not, to do a 20-minute history lecture. So yeah, Vladimir Putin can't get that. And I think it's the very nature of this is honestly kind of pitiful. And there were some real moments in here that jumped out at me as just like...
But what my point is, he's so wealthy and so powerful, but he still comes off a bit huffy. It's so bizarre.
We have done so many gestures of goodwill out of decency that I think we have run out of them.
Exactly, and then he's giving an interview to like the pet of Elon Musk or something like that, a guy who's largely discredited within the United States. That in and of itself is quite humiliating. There's this interesting part. I mean, one of the points where I actually laughed was at some point. You know, he goes, Tucker goes, who blew up Nord Stream? And you know, that Putin goes, you did.
Who blew up Nord Stream?
You for sure.
I was busy that day.
Yeah, it was amusing. But you know, there was a discussion. I can't recall exactly where it was in my notes, but there was a discussion of Germany and Nord Stream. And it was amazing just how quickly Russia goes, so Germany should buy our gas. Germany should buy our gas. You know, he just desperately wants to sell the gas. At some point... There's a number of points here where it's so clear that Tucker Carlson has done almost no homework on the actual conflict and just wants to get his culture war points out. And think how humiliating that is for a head of state to be like, I'm giving an interview with this guy who just wants me to provide fodder for his like online news show. And like, it's really pitiful. So there's this one point where Tucker asks Putin to provide support for the dollar is falling away, the dollar is going away narrative. And it's interesting because Putin does eventually get on board. Like this head of state, this head of a nuclear power eventually starts saying things that Tucker wants to hear about. Oh, like it's as inevitable as the sun going down that China's going to be more powerful. But he starts off as essentially being like, we want to use dollars. It's the United States that's not letting us use dollars.
U.S. dollars accounted for approximately 50% of our transactions with third countries, while currently it is down to 13%. It wasn't us who banned the use of the U.S. dollar.
Then there's just this sort of hint of desperation that sort of like the very act of doing this interview with Tucker Carlson is an act of desperation. The fact that he knows, and he does a really bad job, frankly, of trying to appeal to the U.S. culture war bullshit.
Look out across what's happening in the world now. Do you see God at work? Do you ever think to yourself, these are forces that are not human?
No, to be honest, I don't think so.
That's all that Tucker Carlson wants to talk about. And it's profoundly sad. And honestly, the fact that Putin sat for this interview like makes me more optimistic for Ukraine than anything else I've seen this year.
Is Israel mentioned at all in this?
Oh, of course not.
But is Russia not very pro-Israel?
No.
Okay.
Well, it varies.
Okay.
It depends.
I thought he could have played. I thought he would have played up that angle because it was never mentioned at all. I just thought it was strange.
Well, I think don't quote me on this, but I think Tucker has been surprisingly on his ex show has been surprisingly critical of Biden's support for Israel, which is kind of interesting. Well, I mean, the Russian-Israeli relationship is very, very profoundly strange. You know, a quarter of Israelis or something come from Russia over the past 30 years. That's an interesting dynamic. Israel is desperate to continue bombing Syria, which it can only do with Russian permission. So throughout the Ukraine conflict, Israel has been markedly reticent to support Ukraine against Russia. And I think despite certainly using some of this incredible opportunity, I think Putin has said a thing once or twice about how bad what's happening to the Palestinians are. But I think Israel and Russia generally, you know, they got a sort of...
Okay, because it's like 20% of Israel's population speaks Russian.
Yeah. So
but I thought
if
you were trying to win over Americans, you'd either want to be like, oh, you horrible Americans are so evil for supporting this, or, oh, we love Israel. We believe they're great. So since, you know, if you're backing Israel, you want to go against Ukraine. I just felt it was, a missed opportunity. Like, you felt like... be on some side of it, but it wasn't mentioned
at all.
Well,
I think Putin has got to, you know, famously the Russians aren't very good at analyzing U.S. politics, but I think even they have picked up that is perhaps not as Israel support isn't the winner it was 10 years ago or even 5 months ago. It didn't surprise me too much. I do have to say one thing, just like. Interesting just how little preparation Tucker Carlson did for this. It came about 40 minutes in.
Because realistically, if you got the call, like you have to go now, how much prep could you do in a plane? Like if it was literally you have to go now, Vladimir Putin's given you a slot and you have to be there tomorrow.
Did he get, is that how that happened?
No, I'm saying that's not what happened, but I'm just saying worst case scenario, like a lot of people and any journalist worth their salt will be able to cram for something like this.
Yeah, exactly. Like honestly, I would have read the Ukraine Wikipedia page or something, you know, like, cause it was just fucking amazing. So basically Putin at 41 minutes in starts talking about the Orange Revolution. The Orange Revolution was basically that there was Yanukovych in 2004 was elected president of Ukraine, and there was creditable enough accusations that the runoff election was fraudulent, so they did it over again, and our guy won in 2004. So he's clearly talking about the Orange Revolution in 2004, and Tucker Carlson's like, oh, you mean in 2014?
In 2014.
Yep.
Before that. No, this was before that, after President Kuchma, Viktor Yanukovych, won the elections.
And it's just like, he just didn't have the basics. I mean, Christ almighty, like, if you're gonna go and interview a head of state operating a war against the country, like, know the basic history of the conflict
and this will
between
be
these two countries.
This will be the highlight of Tucker's career. Like he's probably if he's going to go down in history, this will be it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he didn't think he should revise for it. If you're going to cheat, could he not have like an earpiece and just have someone in the back being like, "Oh, ask him this, ask him this, ask him this."
But it's just kind of extraordinary that he did not know the basics here.
But he did mention about the American journalist that's currently imprisoned in Russia, which I didn't expect him to.
He did at the end there. And he was like, well, you know, the amazing thing was at the end. He was like, it was fascinating, like the self-delusion Tucker Carlson being like, you know, feeling like a visiting head of state or like an ex-president or something, being like, would you give us Evan Gershkovich? You know, as a sign of your goodwill, and it's just like, did he think he was Jimmy Carter or something? It's just the delusions of grandeur of Tucker Carlson.
Without getting into the details of it or your version of what happened, if as a sign of your decency, you would be willing to release him to us and we'll bring him back to the United States.
If you could ask Putin any question, what would you ask him?
Oh, that's a great question, Rory. I hadn't thought about that at all. Look at me being unprepared.
Well, you didn't think you were going to interview him, to be fair.
No. I would want like to know, like, in his description, what was the point at which he sort of knew he wouldn't be able to, you know, I would like to know if there was anything Joe Biden could have done that would have stopped the war. I think what was interesting that it's fascinating the way that Tucker Carlson had to dance around the fact that, you know, as is probably clear by this point, I'm a little more sympathetic to Tucker Carlson's interpretation that the United States pushed Russia towards war than any other analyst in the U.S. I do not think that Putin's war was justified. Let me qualify that. But I do think the U.S. played a huge role in pushing that that war. But what's an interesting question that I would like to have resolved. So what Tucker Carlson had to avoid, because he's still very much a Trumper, is he had to avoid the inconvenient fact that it was Donald Trump who cast the die in Ukraine. It was Donald Trump who allowed the Ukrainian government to abandon Minsk. It was Donald Trump who heavily armed the Ukrainians.
I think, wasn't it up until then, it was quite often non-lethal aid America was giving?
Yes, until Trump.
And then
Trump started
giving them javelins and things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My question, this is something I think about a lot, in the year that Joe Biden was president, could he have righted the ship from Trump's policy of insane aggression? Could, if Joe Biden had said, you know what, we're going to get more serious about the Minsk process, we're going to stop encouraging Ukraine to be as aggressive as it is, you know, could Joe Biden have averted it, or was the die already cast? Like, was it already inevitable? And that's something I wonder about a lot, that if there was anything Joe Biden could have done to stop the process towards war that Obama had started and Trump had accelerated. That's a really interesting question to me. One of my pet things is that, honestly, if the U.S. media hadn't given Biden so much crap for Afghanistan, you know, maybe...
Oh, yeah, he'd be less gung-ho for war?
Yeah, maybe Biden would have said to Zelensky, hey, just commit to not getting into NATO. And none of this could have happened. I think that's a real possibility. But yeah, I would love to see what Putin thought if there was by the time Joe Biden was president, there was still a chance to stop this war. That's what I would ask Vladimir Putin. I don't know. Maybe there was a chance to stop it. Maybe there wasn't. But I do know that it was Obama that sort of started this march to war, Donald Trump that accelerated it, and Joe Biden that completed it. So, yeah.
And on that cheery note, we will catch you next time.
Indeed.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.